announce the next three commitments. And then we're going to have a progress report to prove that we are serious about keeping score. And I think you'll like it. The next group of commitments impacts, this is almost unimaginable to me, a staggering 2.5 billion people who lack access to basic sanitation. Poor water and poor sanitation accounts for 3.5 million deaths a year. More than 1.5 million children die each year from diarrhea-related diseases. To promote these issues, the United Nations has declared 2008 the Year of International Sanitation. The diversity of groups involved in this commitment understand the importance of taking action now and working locally to affect change globally. Their work will improve lives and bolster local economies. Every dollar invested in water and sanitation programs yields an $8 benefit. When fully implemented, these commitments will reach 8.5 million people, providing more than 1 billion liters of clean water, saving lives, making progress. Tom Khalil, the chair of Global Health Working Group, will introduce the participants who are committed to working on water and sanitation. Tom, come up here and introduce them, then we'll get them going.
Thanks. Good. Thank you, Mr. President. I'm proud to announce the following individuals and organizations that are working to improve access to safe drinking water and effective sanitation. And I'd also like to acknowledge the incredibly hard work of UC Berkeley graduate Leah Marshall for putting this together. Claire Lyons from PepsiCo Foundation and Gary White from Water Partners are investing $4 million in Water Credit, an innovative model that uses microcredit to expand access to safe drinking water and sanitation in India. PepsiCo Foundation is also partnering with the Safe Water Network to provide safe water, health, and hygiene to 200,000 people in Ghana, India, and Bangladesh. Sarah Shannon from the Hesperian Foundation is partnering with the Kind World Foundation to distribute educational resources on water, sanitation, and health in 20 different languages. Musician Feliciano Dos Santos will use the power of song and grassroots activism to provide water, sanitation, and hygiene to 50 villages in his home country of Mozambique. Sally Cole from Population Services International will distribute integrated health care packages to 500,000 children in Madagascar. John Lane of the Water Supply and Sanitation Collaborative Council will mobilize an additional $30 million for the Global Sanitation Fund to invest in sanitation interventions for poor people worldwide. Dr. Socorro Gross from the Pan American Health Organization will collaborate with ministers of health in 10 Latin American countries to promote water, sanitation, and nutrition for 2 million women and children. Greg Allgood with Procter & Gamble will supply 1 billion liters of safe drinking water worldwide and launch a media and awareness-raising campaign that will reach over 300 million households. Dr. Bindeshwar Pathak of Sulab International Social Services Organization will help 5 developing country governments adopt sanitation technologies and social movements. Marc Joubert of the One by One Foundation will partner with H2O Africa to raise at least $1 million for water partners providing safe water and sanitation to over 55,000 people. Representing a collaboration of 24 organizations, Paul Faith of the Global Water Challenge will secure funding for the winners of a global competition to promote innovations in water and sanitation. Michelle Leiden from Global Action will work with the Robert Heinrich Family Foundation to add water purification practices to a micronutrient fortification program for 25,000 children living in Tanzania. Jeff Albert with the Aquia Institute will validate a financially sustainable approach to providing community-level water treatment in Kenya. Lisa Conte from Napo Pharmaceuticals, in partnership with Direct Relief International, will develop and provide at cost a new pharmaceutical to treat pediatric diarrheal diseases in low-income countries. Please join me in acknowledging all these people for making tremendous commitments to provide safe drinking water and sanitation to millions of people around the world.
I'd like to now invite the next group of people to the stage. Eli Brode and Edie Brode, the co-founders of the Eli and Edith Brode Foundation. Roland Fryer, Harvard Economics Professor and CEO of the New Education Innovation Lab at Harvard. Steve Hyman, Provost at Harvard. Joel Klein, the Chancellor of our schools here in New York City. And Larry Summers, member of the Brode Foundation Board of Governors, former President of Harvard, former Secretary of the Treasury under some previous administration. The Brode Foundation, Harvard, the Department of Education, the cities of Chicago, New York, and the District of Columbia have made a commitment to create the Harvard Innovation Lab for the study of urban public schools, valued at $44 million over the next 3 years. To put this commitment into some context, in addition to the high-performing charter schools we have seen, like KIPP, which have a great school in the Mississippi Delta in my home state, we have seen recent innovations that have heightened the academic achievement of some of our most disadvantaged children. Now, with a focus on New York, Chicago, and the District of Columbia, the Education Innovation Lab will provide objective measurement for urban school district programs for grades K through 12, using research and development models based on the National Institute of Health and the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or DARPA. Basically, let me say to all of you that I have said this in many times in many places. I think that the work that Eli and the Brode Foundation have done to promote educational improvement outstrips just about anything anybody's done in this category anywhere in the country. In terms of training new and different kinds of school leaders, finding ways of measuring whether what you're doing has worked, and finding ways to put innovation in the whole system. The number one problem with American public education is that the incentives and the systems necessary to replicate excellence have never been established, not anywhere in America, on a comprehensive basis. It is not true that there are no good public schools. It is not true that there are no good schools operating at global levels. But it is true that there is no single state even where we can say that there is a rigorous commitment to and ability to replicate excellence. And that's the problem. And there's a better chance that it'll be solved because of this extraordinary, generous commitment. And I, for one, am profoundly grateful. And I hope all of you are too. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's give them another hand. The third commitment involves a sustainability commitment. I'd like to ask Matt Kistler, the Senior Vice President for Sustainability at Walmart, to come up. Walmart is working with the Environmental Defense Fund, or Environmental Defense, and all their suppliers. This is a big deal. Listen to this. You ever thought I'd use the words Walmart and Environmental Defense in the same sentence? They're working with Environmental Defense and all of their suppliers of plastic shopping and reusable bags to reduce their global plastic shopping bag waste by a third per store by 2013. That has the potential to reduce just the shopping bags, listen to this, 290,000 metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions every year. This is not beanbag here. Roughly the equivalent of taking 53,000 passenger vehicles off the road. And let me say, to put this in some context, this is a company that has made changes in its supply chain already sufficient to take hundreds of thousands of diesel trucks off the road by reducing the size of its packaging. And Walmart has committed its British affiliate to being a zero waste producing enterprise by 2010. This is part of and has begun to work with its suppliers to help them lower their use of energy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So this advance we celebrate today is not the biggest thing that Walmart has done in this area. But I wanted to do this because, number one, it's kind of cool, the whole shopping bag deal, and it makes a nice picture. But number two, it makes the larger point I have been trying to hammer home like a broken record since we started on this climate change thing, which is that all the talk in the world is fine. You must have a specific strategy. People have to have operational plans that they can all be a part of. And I will say that Matt Kistler and the whole Walmart crowd are geniuses at breaking big problems down into very bite-sized, chewable component parts and then chewing through it until you add it all up, and they have made breathtaking savings in reducing their greenhouse gas emissions and increasing, it, by the way, the income of their suppliers and balancing economic growth while reducing the problem. So I'm thrilled. And I want to thank you. You will reduce the more than 29 billion plastic bags it produces each year. You want me to say that number again? Working on a local basis in every country in which they operate to develop low-cost reusable bags and increase recycling. That will create locally owned businesses. And it will take, listen to this, just what they're committing to do today, will take 9.5 billion plastic shopping bags out of the world's waste stream. And quite apart, 9.5 billion, and apart from the greenhouse gas reduction, it takes a plastic bag put into the ground 1,000 years to decompose. They're doing a good thing, folks. Turns out to be good business, too. Thank you very much. I was looking at this totally reusable natural bag, thinking that the next big step in this development is finding a reusable bag that you take your dog walking with. But I thank you. This is great, a really great thing. Now, before we get on to the next plenary, I want to do one other thing. You may have noticed outside, we've tried to give evidence of the 240, more or less, commitments that have been completed and what has happened to them. Because I think that's important to show that this process is going on. A lot of these commitments are multi-year. But I want to do one in particular up here. And so let me just say this. 2 years ago in 2006, Dana Frayer, the chair and co-founder of the Global Partnership for Afghanistan, committed to launch, and I announced, I remember it as if it were yesterday because I thought it was a pretty cool commitment, 100 commercially viable orchard and woodlot businesses, separate businesses, 100 new businesses. Each was projected to provide financial support to a family of 7 or more. The commitment was important because at the time, Afghanistan's average per capita income was still well under a dollar a day. I want to ask Dana Frayer to come up here and give us an update on the commitment she made 2 years ago. Let's give her a hand.
Thank you, Mr. President. Since we made our commitment in 2006, we've partnered with more than 9,000 enterprise farmers, women and men, in 300 villages across Afghanistan, and helped them move away from the poppy trade by developing commercially viable poplar woodlot and nursery enterprises. Our staff of nearly 100 Afghans has collected 1.7 million budwood cuttings of fruit trees and supplied them to government and private nurseries to ensure consistent supply of quality plant material, critical in a country suffering from massive deforestation. But statistics alone can't explain the impact of this commitment. A farmer from Farza, whose house and land had been destroyed by the Taliban, planted 8,000 poplar cuttings. And next year, she'll harvest those cuttings and will repay her in-kind loan to our organization. Most importantly, she'll sell cuttings and saplings for income that will support her family, including her 7 children and disabled husband, and provide additional income that will help her children go to university. And another farmer who planted just a tenth of an acre with our ultra-fast growing poplars said, "With this kind of short-term profit and more revenue when trees are harvested, there's no need to even consider poppies with all the problems they bring." We look forward to continuing our work creating sustainable livelihoods for Afghan farmers and fending off the need for them to plant poppies. And to scale our efforts this year, we've committed to CGI to launch the Treehouse, an Afghan-run center for excellence in farm forestry and horticulture and related education, training, and entrepreneurship. And we expect to have 4 million trees planted by the end of 2009 alone, and thousands of additional farmers engaged in profitable enterprises, including a large percentage of them women. And we will be growing a cadre of trained farmers and professionals to train other farmers throughout the country. So we thank you, President Clinton, and those of you at the Clinton Global Initiative who are helping us help farmers who are shunning poppies and investing in tree self-sufficiency and economic security for Afghanistan. Thank you very much.
We're going to start the next panel, but I want to make 3 very important points about what you just heard. Number one, she not only kept her commitment, she did more than 4 times what she promised to do. Okay, she helped 9,000 people instead of 2,000. That's the first thing. Number two, think of the implications that this has, not just for the future of Afghanistan and whether they can resist the entreaties or the brutality, as the case may be, of a resurgent Taliban and their Al-Qaeda allies. But what it might mean all over the world when you're told over and over again, well, in all these areas where they're growing poppy or coca, the farmers are basically good people and they'd like to do something else, but there's just nothing remotely economically as effective. She, Dana, found trees that could grow, fruit that could be produced, wood capacity that could be developed, in a way that enabled both the trees to be cut and the trees to grow and to increase the forest cover. So it turns out it is good economics for them. And that should mean not that the same answers might be present in the rainforests in Colombia, but that there probably are answers. And that sometimes people like you, who have the time, effort, and intensity to keep digging around in this, may be better at that than people in the government for whom it might be a legal responsibility. The third thing I would like to say is that the loss of forest cover is a terrible problem, not just for climate change, but also for the loss of biodiversity. And we have learned in painful ways that just preaching about it doesn't work. And it's a big obstacle to what we need to be doing in Haiti. In many places in Africa with economic downturn, with the rising cost of food and energy, you've got people, after having supported new forest stands for years now, tearing them down and using the wood for charcoal. So I think this model here is also very important for those of you who go at this primarily from global warming, reforestation, and species preservation option. If you want to preserve the species, this is a particularly big issue in Southeast Asia and in Latin America. We have to find a way to enable people to plant and harvest on land already taken down in order to save what is left. So I just want you to know, I'm very moved by what this unduly modest woman has said here tonight. And I do want to emphasize to you, she promised to do this, and she did four times plus what she promised. She got the results she hoped and then some, and she gave us a model for how to deal with reforestation and the displacement of very serious narcotics business. For all that, we are very much in your debt. Congratulations, thank you, and God bless you. This is great. All right. Now let's get to the next plenary. What are we doing, Tom? This happened once before where we had a time lag. Mayor Bloomberg, I think you're supposed to be here, but I don't have a list of everyone who's coming out. You going to introduce people?
Ladies and gentlemen, the mayor, City of New York, Michael R. Bloomberg.
This is Paul Hawken, who has been a big influence on me for a long time. He was the first successful entrepreneurial environmentalist I ever came across in my first term as governor, which was practically in the Middle Ages. In 1979, 1980, I asked him, and I said, Paul, when did you write your first book? He said, 1979. I said, I read it when I was governor. And I became influenced, and a lot of you may remember, those of you who were alive in that distant era, that under President Carter was in office, and we were trying in a different way to have an environmentally responsible, sustainable energy policy. Paul Hawken was the first person I ever read 28 years ago who convinced me that being responsible with energy and natural resources would in the long run be better economics, long before most of us knew there was such a thing as global warming. In 1983, I went to a governor's conference. He came out with his second book. I was passing it out to my colleagues. 25 years later, I still look forward to what he has to say. He wrote a book with Amory and Hunter Lovins called Natural Capitalism, which I still believe is one of the most important contributions to the fight against climate change, because if you pick up that book, you will never again be able to say, I cannot figure out what to do myself, and I am not sure it will make a difference. You lose all your excuses reading it, because it not only educates you, it empowers you. So thank you for being here.
Ladies and gentlemen, the founder Inter-American Development Bank, Luis Alberto Moreno.
The director of the Inter-American Bank is my very close friend because he was ambassador from Colombia to the United States the whole time I was president when we did Plan Colombia and we tried to save America's oldest democracy, except for the United States and the entire Americas, from becoming a narco state instead of a great democracy. We did it thanks to the leadership of former President Pastrana, who's here, President Uribe, and this good man who helped us sell this program. And now, in his current role, he works with me in the project I mentioned earlier with Frank Giustra, Carlos Slim, and others in Peru and Colombia trying to develop sustainable economies in places where mining occurs. It's going to be a big deal for those of you who are environmentalists. If the world population grows from 6.5 to 9 billion in the next 43 years, there's one thing you can be sure of. I don't care what happens to the banks or anything else. You can invest in mining because people will take more stuff out of the ground if there are more people alive on the surface of the earth. It is inevitable. We now have all these mining companies wanting to spend money while they are mining to recover the land, to be environmentally responsible, to create sustainable economies so that the minute the mines play out, the communities are already better off than they were when the mining was going on. It is a very ambitious project, and Mr. Moreno, who's not only my friend, is a very good economist and loves Latin America, was there at the presence of the birth of this project and pledged the expertise and the research and the support of the Inter-American Development Bank to it. So, you guys, if we pull this off, it'll be a pretty good hat trick. Thank you.
Former Ambassador of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to the United States of America, His Royal Highness Prince Turki Al-Faisal Al-Saud. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our moderator, former President Ireland, President Realizing Rights, the Ethical Globalization Initiative, Mary Robinson.
Let me say before President Robinson takes the program, I want to tell you something about Turki Faisal. Besides the fact that we graduated from college together in 1968 at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And by the time I became president, he had been head of the intelligence services of Saudi Arabia for quite a long time. And we'd go to all these meetings, and because of protocol, he was supposed to pretend he didn't know me, either that or he was just embarrassed to be my friend. But we didn't just go to college together. We actually knew each other. We on occasion studied together, a condition that both of us tried to avoid whenever we could. He was a good ambassador to the United States. He was a good ambassador to Great Britain. He was a good and faithful and patriotic head of the intelligence services, but in that context was a friend of the United States. And he is spending these years when he could be doing whatever he wants, trying to figure out how to modernize Saudi Arabia, empower all of its people, and what the country ought to look like 10 years from now. He is a very good man, even if he has been my friend for more than 40 years. I promise you, everybody knew what he would become, and no one would have dreamed that I'd have been with him 40 years ago, but I'm glad we're here together today. Mary Robinson is a visionary, and when she quit being president of Ireland, most people thought that she could not afford, and the world could not afford, to have her underemployed. And so she is involved in a whole host of things, and I'm gratified that she came here, but I really admire her, and I was honored that she took an official visit to the United States when she was president. And this may be, depending on what his future holds in mind, my last chance to say something publicly about one of the greatest mayors that this city or any city ever had in our long and storied history. And I'm not going to say what I, because I'll get in trouble if I say what I'm really thinking, but let me just say this. There is, in my judgment, no job to be done in America in any area of importance to our future that he would probably not do better than just about anybody else I ever met. I think he's great.
Well, thank you, President Clinton, for helping me greatly as moderator with those introductions of the panel. It is, for me, truly an honor to chair this wonderful panel on such an important subject, meeting the demands of population growth and urbanization. I just want to make a few comments at the beginning about the panel. First of all, a broad observation, not too gender balanced. Don't worry, I'll handle that, no problem. I'd like to add just a small personal touch. Before Prince Tokay became a distinguished ambassador to the United States, he was an ambassador in my country and our near neighbor, Britain. And we also know each other through the group called the C100 in the World Economic Forum, which you have been co-chair of for a long number of years. Mr. Mayor, I have a special interest in you continuing to do the job well, because I've been residing in your city since 2002. I have a home in Ireland, but this is my workplace, so I have noted that you deserve the applause as a very distinguished mayor. And Mr. Moreno, you reminded me that when you were serving in a distinguished capacity as ambassador of Colombia here in the United States, that we had some conversations on issues of human rights and issues of the progress in that whole region. And it's wonderful to have you on the panel. And I have been looking forward very much to meeting you, Paul, and you remember inside I gave you my card because I really want that book too. So thank you very much. And I was just thinking in being invited to moderate this panel that, among many others, I think, I've been speaking quite a bit recently about the rural poor and the need for emphasis. But in fact, it's good that now we're focusing on population and the urban population. Because last year, 2007, we saw a significant change in the world. For the first time, those living in urban areas were 50% of the population of the world. And it's more than that in some regions, as we will hear. And so that is a big change and a big challenge to us. And when we talk about the scale of the population, and we know that there will be a very significant increase in population in the next 50 years. We also talk about the youth of the population. And Prince Tokay, if I can come to you first on that issue of the population in your region. I think it's fair to say that somewhat 65% of the population is under 30. And there is also a worrying figure of very high rates of unemployment. So first of all, in a broad sense, how do leaders in your region see a young, unemployed population as an asset rather than a serious burden?
Thank you very much, Ms. Robinson. Let me start by thanking President Clinton for inviting me to attend this august meeting that he holds since 4 years. And I would just like to remind him that we shared the class that did not inhale. But to more serious business, the population of Saudi Arabia is growing and growing exponentially. But in the past 10 years, there's been a noticeable decline in the rate of growth. And I think those are issues that have to do with two basic things that are happening in Saudi Arabia, and I think in other countries in the area as well. The increase in education and increase in the job opportunities, particularly for women. I can give you an example. I am the father of 7 children. My son, my eldest son, he is now 32 years old, 33 years old, and he has only one child. and other families are like that. It's been not necessarily a result of government action or religious edict that has led to this example of the decrease in the rate of increase in population, but rather the changing circumstances of life in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Economic opportunity and other factors have definitely allowed for people to seek better lives, and in doing so, keeping a smaller family. And more increasingly, particularly in the last 10 to 15 years, the female member of that family is going out to be a breadwinner as well. And that has definitely contributed to the decline in the rate of the increase, if I'm not making too many contradictions there. And I think that's probably true in other countries in the area. But population is as Ms. Robinson said, Yani, Saudi Arabia has a very youthful bulge in its population. And although the unemployment in the past 20 years reached probably levels of nearly 20%, the last figure I saw from government statistics, and I don't know if you're like me, you're not many times too certain of government statistics, it's come down to something like 9.1%. I would accept that coming from my government, but nonetheless, for a country that has so much development taking place in it and so many projects that are being undertaken, whether in the private enterprise or the public enterprise, 9.1% is still too high a percentage for a country like Saudi Arabia. And the only way to deal with that is through education. Education is the place where the youth will get the skills and the know-how to be able to compete, because also in the last couple of days, I must add that I sort of felt that everybody is beating down on me coming from Saudi Arabia, the oil-producing country in the world. And I must say that it's not very comfortable when you have Vice President Gore and President Clinton and Senator Obama and Senator McCain beating down on you. God help you if you're in that position. But nonetheless, I think what we have accomplished in Saudi Arabia is that we have recognized that this major resource that we have, which is oil, is depletable. And our major investment is in our people. They are not depletable. And that is why education and job opportunities are the main thrust of the Saudi government these days.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, I'd like to draw on your experience. You're a two-term mayor so far anyway, and you're a mayor of what's known as a megacity. And I've been looking at some of the statistics, the predictions of the growth of cities, and I note that New York and Tokyo will only grow about another million between now and 2025. But that cities like Delhi in India will grow from 15.9 to 22.5 million in the same period, that Calcutta will grow from 14.8 to 20.6, and that Dhaka in Bangladesh will grow from 13.5 to 22 million, and that Egypt, Cairo in Egypt, will grow from 11.9 to 15.6. The point I want to make is you're addressing the problems of a city knowing that that city won't necessarily grow that much. What about cities that are going to grow 4, 6, 8 million in that short period?
There's very different results in growth, cities in the developed world versus cities in the non-developed world. And it all has to do with infrastructure. If you don't have water and sewage and electricity, if you don't have roads and mass transit and schools, then the results can be calamitous. Life expectancy in New York back in like 1900 was probably half a dozen years lower than in the rest of this country. Today, life expectancy in New York City is a good year higher or greater than in the United States as a whole, a number that I keep touting. If you want to live longer, move to New York. But statistically, it really is true. And the reason is we have the infrastructure. And if you look at our Plan YC, we're focusing on improving that infrastructure so that when the population grows, we can accommodate it. If you take a look at some of the cities in the developing world, people are moving in from the countryside because they are starving in the countryside. And they tend to bring very big families with them. They tend not to have a lot of formal education so that the jobs that they can take are relatively limited. And that's going to be the great challenge. You easily see with dense populations problems with health that will spread very quickly, problems with intolerance for others, and you start to see that, ethnic battles and religious battles. You can see a competition for resources that will not be pleasant, whereas in a big city like New York, even our poorest do relatively well compared to elsewhere.
Mr. Marino, I said that the overall statistic in 2007 was that we now have 50% of the world that is urban. But in your region, I understand it's about 75%. Can you explain maybe why this is so, and do you see that as a positive development because it's presumably going to continue and increase, or do you see it as a particular challenge?
Well, certainly it has a lot of challenges, and this happened in Latin America in a period of about 40 years. And actually, if you were to project the numbers out, it's probably going to be closer to 85% by 2025. In fact, there's cities, of those mega cities that you mentioned, there's basically two in Latin America that are over 15 million people, being Mexico City and Sao Paulo, and then you have Rio right behind with about 10 million people or 11 million people. So the reality is that the challenges for those cities, and I think that's really the fundamental issue here, is huge challenge in transportation. Why? Latin America has undergone, over the last 5 years, a process of economic growth that by the combination of a cheap dollar, low interest rates, people are buying a huge amount of automobiles, thousands of automobiles entering major cities every day, which poses a huge challenge for public transportation. There is no major city in Latin America today that is not looking at a program to develop mass transit systems, and there's been actually a lot of innovation. Then something Mayor Bloomberg was saying is the whole question of social networks and how they are deployed, be it education, be it health. This is a huge challenge today in many of the cities in Latin America that have a direct component with this, normally what the literature would tell you, the youth bulge, which is connected to crime. If you look at the middle of the 80s, when Latin America was at the midst of its debt crisis, crime rates in the top 10 cities are probably half then than they were today. In other words, they doubled. And they double largely because people come into the cities, they come in the forms of squatters, and there's that whole social fabric that needs to be built. And in that respect, it's very important to certainly invest in law enforcement, but just as important to have social investment and to create, recreation, to create music, to get microfinance. These are the kinds of things many cities are working in, and certainly the challenges of climate change, which are terribly important, not only from the perspective of emissions, but also the dynamic of energy efficiency.
Thank you. Paul, you've written a lot from a sort of people-centered approach, with particular knowledge of the informal sector. How do you see this issue that we're talking about, population and population growth? And is there a link between urbanization and population growth?
There is a link, and it's inverse to what people think it is. The rapid growth of the megacities and urbanization in general makes us think that cities cause population growth, but actually cities do the opposite. The four empirically proven methods that really change birth rates are education for women, better health care for women and their families, and economic opportunities for women, and the fourth one are cities. And when people move to cities, the birth rate drops beneath the replacement rate. And so there's this, the cities aren't the cause of population growth, they're the expression of it. And what we're seeing is landless people in the country becoming urbanized landless people. But they're going there for a very specific reason. And no one goes to a city to become poor. They go to a city to improve their lives. And so when we think of these squatter settlements, as they're called, whether it's favelas or the chamas or the chals, the different words in different countries, these represent a really significant opportunity, actually, for the transformation of people's lives, as opposed to seeing them as invaders or seeing them as other or seeing them as someone who's messing up, if you will, the polity, messing up, you know, the peace and security of the city. But our approach to them has to change quite dramatically, because right now there's 1 billion of these people in the world, and by 2030, 3 billion of the people in the world will be squatters.
And tell us a little bit about the social networks that have been mentioned. I mean, I'm astounded at the organizational ability and connections now between the slum dwellers and shack dwellers international, waste pickers, WeGo for women in the informal sector. Tell us a little about that. Well, because people tend to think, I think, that squatters are rather passive and not active.
There, it's quite the opposite. I mean, you take Mumbai, for example, which is quite known for the chawls, for the squatters there. But Mumbai as a city contributes 1/6 of the GDP of India.
Exactly.
So there's a lot going on in Mumbai, and most of it's going on by people who we, in a sense, see as other. We ignore them. And the entrepreneurial spirit that's in these cities is quite extraordinary. As in Hernando de Soto pointed out yesterday and has very eloquently, what the people need in these squatter settlements is capital. And they need it in two forms. They need it in terms of microfinance, but they need it in terms of ownership. That is, they need title. They need a place they can call their own, and they need to have a neighborhood in which they feel they are valued and they can add value, as opposed to being transients that can be dislocated at the whim of what Paul Farmer calls the pathologies of corruption, which sweep through these urban areas quite often.
Prince Turki, we know, and it's already been said on this panel, that the best way to have population control, to bring down the growth rate in population, is to educate women and girls and indeed to ensure that they have access to employment. You touched on this in your first response, but I want to push you a little bit. You're talking about a very an area that has very high growth, young population. Is your own country, Saudi Arabia, is the Middle East doing enough to educate women and girls? And if not, what would you say needs to be done?
I don't think anybody has been doing enough to educate women and girls, no matter where they come from. The programs in our part of the world, and I can talk about Saudi Arabia more than others, are very extensive. As you know, there are more women graduating from universities in Saudi Arabia now than there are men. Where we've had a social problem, I think, more than any other issue, is on the issue of jobs, particularly for women. But that's changing. 20 years ago, if you looked at a typical Saudi household, the money earner was the male member of the household, the husband. And he would have felt ashamed, if not downright criminally liable, if you like, to allow either his wife or his daughter or any of his female relatives to go out and seek a job. But because of the changing circumstances, because of the availability of education for women, that has changed. And now the most sought after member of the family, if you like, is the female, even among potential husbands. Because when someone, a husband or a bachelor, wants to start his life He wants someone who can bring in income with him to add to the rising costs, and rising costs are a universal phenomenon that everybody suffers from, whether it is food or other materials, clothes and transport and everything else. But I would also like to refer to what Mr. Hawkins said about the urban redevelopment programs, if you like, because there is a pilot project in the kingdom now in the city of Jeddah, where we suffer from urban ramshackle haphazard housing. The government has called on private enterprise and the actual residents of those neighborhoods to form a corporation where the residents would be partners in this corporation that would then redevelop the area into a more modern and more planned residential or commercial or other service areas, so that the very factor that Mr. Hawkins was talking about, that the residents of these favelas, if you like, or urban neighborhoods would feel not only empowered but also have a stake in the development of this neighborhood, and they feel that they own part of it. I think that's one way of doing it. But the important thing is to keep in mind that it is a joint effort. It's not purely government or purely non-governmental. It has to be a combination of both.
But just getting back to the question about educating women and girls and linking it to the issue of population, do you think there's enough education in the sense of reproductive health and family planning?
I believe so, and not just in the kingdom, but you go throughout the Arab and Muslim world, you'll find that United Nations programs for women and so on are represented quite extensively. And yesterday we had Dr. Thuraya Ubaid, who is the head of the United Nations, I think, Women
Good
Development
friend, yes,
Program.
Head of UNFPA.
She is from Saudi Arabia, yeah. and she makes a point of visiting the countries in the area and initiating programs there. But along with education, I think jobs also are important to make women and families aware of the need for family planning. If a woman wants to go out and work in the job market, she can do it much more efficiently if she is not encumbered with a baby in her belly. And I think people find that everywhere.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, the clock is ticking, which is a pity because this is a good conversation. In a few days' time, on the 6th of October, we'll mark yet again World Habitat Day 2008. And the theme for this year is harmonious cities. If you were asked for a priority of what you must do to bring about a harmonious city, what would you?
Well, you have to get people to live together and work together. And that's what's different about New York. I've given this speech 1,000 times, but in New York, in the same block, you can have different buildings uses and all different ethnicities and different economic levels. So while people may not socialize together, strangers don't appear threatening. And that's one of the reasons the city has functioned so well. Immigration here is a plus. Sadly, in parts of this country and in many other countries around the world, it is not. And it is only if you keep reinventing your culture and your cuisine and you have people with fresh ideas, entrepreneurs and scientists, would you really be able to stay competitive.
But if I may interrupt you on that point, I mean, as I said, I've been living in your city, and I keep hearing harsher and harsher language and human beings described with a double negative as illegal aliens. You know, you're talking about migrants being very important for the renewal of a city. How do you get that message across more broadly?
Well, by New York's success, hopefully people will follow. I was fascinated by we're talking about the populations growing. one of the big time bombs in our society is for many countries, their population is shrinking, and they're creating time bombs for down the road. China with its one-child policy, Japan, population is actually shrinking today. Western Europe, tends to have birth rates a little over one per couple. In America, we're barely over the maintenance level, 2.1, 2.2. And down the road, we've been transferring a lot of our wealth to the oil-producing countries. The other big transfer of wealth, which nobody's focused on, is we're transferring wealth from the young to the old, but that's going to run out. And we're just going to not have enough young people to be able to support an aging population. That's going to give us a whole different set of problems, particularly in health care, where people tend to use most of their health care budget in the last few years of their lives.
Yeah, thank you. I think you've answered very well that idea of a harmonious city. I think I'd like to put the same question to you, Mr. Moreno, because you talked about the mega cities, the Mexico and Sao Paulo, but actually also in cities you do notice great inequality of wealth. What would you say, maybe from the perspective of the Latin American Development Bank, about what would be the best way to achieve more harmonious cities?
Well, first of all, the biggest growth cities in Latin America today are cities between 50,000 and 500,000 people, 50,000 and a half a million. Those are the ones that are growing the fastest. In terms of the quality of life, there's a number of things, and there's a number of programs that we have been working at the bank. One, which actually Mayor Bloomberg imported to New York, which is this notion of conditional cash transfers. This is extremely important because it works for the poorest people. It started in rural areas, is now applied in urban areas, and is basically to force mothers to send their children to school and make sure that they're going to school, and they are also getting checkups. We're now deploying that into skills to work, which is extremely important, on something that Mayor Bloomberg was mentioning. And then the other part is the whole question of early childhood development. They represent about 25% of the population of Latin America today, but 100% of Latin America's opportunity. And so how do you work very early on with children? The other part is the question of transportation. I think this is a huge challenge, especially in the larger cities. Here it is the question of what normally in the literature they refer as satellite cities that requires, you know, train systems to operate that we don't typically have. And then the whole connection that exists with climate change and energy efficiency.
Mm. Yes, I'm glad you mentioned the climate change. Maybe we'll have time for a round on that particular issue. But, Paul, I wanted to come back to the emphasis you've laid on the active participation of the informal sector. And I've noted that in South Africa, in preparation for the 2010 FIFA World Cup, that there's a whole grassroots movement to prevent what sometimes happens when you have big events, that the event means that the poor are shafted out of their tenements, out of their shacks, etc. They have no land tenure, and the rich in the city may benefit, but it makes life worse for the poorer. And what they have, apparently, is a campaign to support world-class cities for all. Can you tell us a little about that?
Exactly. I think this is the first time that an international meeting or convention or coming together has actually taken into consideration those who are considered so-called the least of us, which I do not think they are the least of us. And can you imagine what a difference that's going to make in terms of the World Cup, in terms of the fans, the participation, the attitudes of the people, the sense of inclusion that they now have, that not only are they coming to town, but in fact, their lives will be improved therein. And I think this is really instructive to us. Again, this is either a liability or a resource. I mean, there's two ways to look at this burgeoning squatter settlements that are happening around the world. And it's so important to understand that, you know, I mean, people come to the city, as I said, to improve their lives. In the countryside, a lot of children actually is a benefit. It really is in terms of security. But in the city itself, actually, they are not. They are a liability. And so the tendency for a couple is to have one or two children and really focus their meager resources, but their resources nevertheless on the education of their daughter mm-hmm. or their son. And this is potentially transformative. And I feel like what Prince Turki spoke about is so important. And that is that so often we talk about these improvement plans or these development plans or these, you know, sort of top-down ways in which we're going to aid these people in their third person. But I actually feel like if we talk to those who pay the highest price, the women, children, you know, and the localized poor, they will tell us what to do. They will tell us what they need. And it's really a matter more of us providing the facilitation of those tools and the, and their needs in a way, because they want to do it themselves. Mm. It's not that they want it done for them. And this is what's happening here with the FIFA Cup in South Africa. It's quite elegant.
And hopefully it will roll over to Brazil when it next hosts the World Cup. We have, I think, let's go into injury time for one short thing. Your worst fear for climate change, Mr. Mayor?
Well, New York is a city that per capita is very environmentally friendly. Because of its magnitude, we produce more greenhouse gases than Portugal. But per capita, because of mass transit and the density of population and living and walking, we're good. My great fear is that the cost of energy will come down rapidly and so low that we will forget the lessons that we should have learned and we'll walk away from the environmental challenges. So when somebody says we like low-cost energy, short term, that makes you feel good, but long, and it may even be good for the economy short term, but long term, that's not good. We would be better off if for a period we had to make the sacrifices, we had to make the investments, and with the short time frame that we all seem to have in a I want it now and I want it for me and I want it free kind of world we live in, my great fear is we're going to walk away from the lessons of the past.
Wise words. Mr. Moreno, climate change?
Look, this is an issue that is already with us, and certainly in Latin America as a whole, we are not producing emissions. We have a lot of sinks, and the real test is how to create that awareness in people, especially in countries, around, say, in the Central America and the Caribbean, where you're seeing the devastation that has been happening recently. We're experimenting, hopefully, with the Clinton Foundation, around doing, for instance, hybrid buses. We're doing things, for instance, in Mexico City on a landfill where it's the largest landfill in Mexico City that can capture methane gas to about the 2 megahertz. So these kinds of things are the ones that need to be introduced around the delivery of public service. There's a huge area to work there in energy efficiency.
Thank you. Mr. Turki, I'll give you last word on climate change. It'll have to be brief because we're in injury time.
To deal with climate change, you have to deal with it globally, and you have to be inclusive. You can't think of us as oil producers as the enemy. We're partners in this. We'd like to be partners with everybody. And the Kingdom was initiated the establishment of the International Energy Forum based in Riyadh and run by a Norwegian Secretary General. Come and sit down with us. Let's discuss this in a global manner. We have to benefit, and you have to benefit. But don't continually use us for political purposes. Don't beat down on us and use polemic when you need to use science and goodwill. This is what we have to offer to our children and our grandchildren.
Well, I think we've ranged quite far in this panel, but I think it's such an incredibly important subject, the whole area of the shift from the rural to the urban, the population increase by 3 billion over such a short space of time, and all the issues. I can't think of a more interesting panel of four people to address these issues with, but reluctantly, I have to now ask everybody to show their appreciation and call this to an end. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the plenary session is now concluded. Your working sessions will begin promptly at 2 p.m. Please proceed to your next session. Thank you.